to really get the why, if you will, from the pharmacist in terms of why this particular drug was an exception to the general rule. That being said, Dr. Burns, when she hung up the phone, was confident in her ability to prescribe the drug based on her reliance, a good faith reliance, on what the pharmacist had told her. This was further because the prescriptions went through and even went through an approval process with the patient's health insurance, which was part of the medical records that we submitted. And I believe that should be a parcel of the package that is provided to the board for review of Dr. Burns' case. Not only was the original drug approved, the follow-up refill prescriptions were approved as well. It was only the very last prescription that ultimately she received a notice with respect to it not going through the pre-approval process, but that ultimately actually did get dispensed by the pharmacy. Now, when Dr. Burns had contacted the pharmacy board, it was completely unrelated to the Viagra prescription because at that time, a few months later, she was still under the good faith belief, particularly in light of the fact that the health insurance company had authorized and sent through the prescription, but that this Viagra was in fact within virtual prescribing ability. She had actually called the board on the COVID matter to ask some questions about COVID-19. and prescribe that medication.
So Dr. Burns was basically doing kind of adjunctive care to the primary care physician?
From what we understand, yes, and we do not have copies of the primary care physician medical records, but Dr. Burns was specifically treating the patient for menopausal issues with natural hormones, medications, things of that nature, and so any treatment that the patient was receiving from her primary care physician would have been separate and apart, if you will, from the hormonal menopausal issues that the patient presented with.
And I realize you didn't deal with the patient, but from what you've gathered, is the patient okay with going back to the primary for the Vyvanse?
I have Dr. Burns here, and she's nodding her head yes. And based on my, I can have her answer directly to you if you would like, but based on our conversations as well as the medical records, the patient is incredibly understanding, even apologetic in any extent. But of course, Dr. Burns apologized to her and said, I'm sorry, I cannot prescribe the medication that I thought I could. And the patient was perfectly fine with going to her primary care physician or seeking out a different doctor, if you will, to assist in utilizing or prescribing the Vyvanse because based on what she relayed to Dr. Burns, and also referenced in the medical record, the Vyvanse was actually working very, very well for the patient and she was very happy with it. So her intention, even though Dr. Burns could no longer prescribe that medication, our understanding is her intention was to continue that medication just through a different doctor who had the scope of work, if you will, that could actually prescribe that medication.
Okay. And then for my clarification, there were, three prescriptions for Vyvanse to that particular patient?
Yes, and I believe a copy of the response that we have submitted dated July 23rd is in the package of information that was provided to you. But just so you know, there were three. There was essentially one in March 6th, 2020. That was the date that Dr. Burns had the conversation with the pharmacist, and that's when she first prescribed it. That was for a 10 milligram dosage of Vyvanse, which is the milligram is recommended as a starting point, if you will. And on March 12, 2020, so approximately a week later, 6 days, Dr. Burns received that prior authorization request from OptumRx and notification that Vyvanse was approved as written. And it was filled ultimately by Walgreens. I believe we wrote April 13, 2020 on our letter. That was a typo. It should have been March 13, 2020. The second prescription was April 1, 2020. And due to COVID, that was a follow-up phone consultation with the patient. And the patient had reported that she was doing well on the 10 milligrams of Vyvanse, although she was not seeing as much improvement as she had hoped. And the patient requested or asked whether or not there was a different dose that could possibly work better. Dr. Burns at that point in time indicated that she had placed her on a low dose to see whether or not it was working for the patient. And given the positive results, Dr. Burns then raised the dosage of the Vyvanse prescription to 30 milligrams. April 7th, so approximately a week later again, Dr. Burns received that second prior authorization request from OptumRx, and as was noted specifically thereon, the prescription was approved and filled, and the patient picked that up on April 8th. May 4th was a return follow-up appointment with Dr. Burns and the patient. The patient reported she was doing very well, much better on the 30 milligrams of Vyvanse. The patient felt she could concentrate, get more tasks accomplished. In addition, they discussed the hormones and the supplements, if you will, that Dr. Burns had her on for some things of that nature. Dr. Burns refilled the Vyvanse prescription of that 30 milligrams on May 4th. May 20th, when she received the OptumRx prior authorization request, which noted that the prescription had actually been canceled. In light of this, and to the best of Dr. Burns' recollection, prescription because they wasn't sure why it had been handled, if that was maybe something procedural. And Walgreens, that she said that is saying, hey, this prescription should have been filled
I'm assuming that's by mouth. but there's no doubt given. So the doctor isn't to know, and when assessing a case, should it become an issue, or just for reference, in case the patient asks, we need to know how many, and so the doctor should too, know how many milligrams they're prescribing. Most of the physicians carry a certain brand and a certain product, so they refer to Bacopa, which means we have their own medicinary. But that doesn't necessarily mean the patient knows they're searching for themselves. And so I find it much better to be specific to the brand that your patients are getting upon in their dosage. I would say that burns, this is something you should be very careful of. I don't find it necessary to bring you back before the board to present us with cases. It's more of a hey, in case your cases come before the board, we're going to be looking at that. Other than that, I would be of the mind to dismiss this case.
I did want to comment on the idea that the insurance approved it. Absolutely not. Would you ever want to rely on insurance approval to give you any sort of voter confidence as to whether or not it's in your restrictive authority?
Dr. Sadlick? Dr. Sadlick?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the back. I'm going to say nay on it.
That was a nay?
Correct.
And did you want to explain your vote or just nay?
My vote would be basically based on prior case and the fact that it had happened three times for a out-of-scope prescription. I would like to see some CME in terms of pharmacology. And I believe really the only way we could have that happen would be either by a, well, not at this point, we're not allowed to do that either. But if there's hours in CME, I don't have a problem with spending high. But if there's no hours with CME in terms of pharmacology, I have an issue with that.
Thank you.
So my motion would stand as nay. However, if there's a guarantee of some sort, it basically have to be verbal that Dr. Burns would do CME, then I would go ahead and switch that. So it's up to you, Dr. Burns, how you want to proceed with that. We can discuss it after Ms. Anthony goes through the roll call.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
I'm going to say nay.
Did you want to explain your vote or just nay? Dr. Campbell?
This is Dr. Campbell. Just as a brief note, I'm going to say I understand both sides of the fence here, and just taking a look at this incident with respect to her conduct after becoming aware of what took place and her actions that she took at that point forward, I think it would be safely indicated for looking at this as what may be her future behavior. And so she acted responsibly once she became aware of the situation, and hopefully that will be off the case in the future and then how she will respond in the future. And so I feel confident to go ahead and vote aye in this case.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, let's move on to case number.
Yes, I'd like to verify Dr. Bailey and her attorney, Ms. Giesel. Are you both on the line?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, on May 17th, 2020, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a notice of an incident which took place on 5-8 of 2020. The incident resulted in respondents' arrest and several offense charges. On May 20th, 2020, a notice of complaint was sent to respondent requesting court records regarding the incident, arrest report, and summary of the events of the incident. Respondent provided a copy of the following, the determination of release conditions and release order, and the ADOT consent affidavit and order of driver's license suspension. Respondent did not provide a copy of the police report stating she nor her attorney had a copy. The police report was later obtained by this investigator through Sedona PD. The police report reflects the following charges, 4 charges of DUI, 2 charges of escape, assault of a police officer, and a traffic offense. According to her written response, respondent claims to have little memory of the incident. While at a friend's house, she consumed 4 glasses of wine over the course of 4 hours. And the next thing she remembers is waking up in her car on the side of the road. On 6/30/2020, I interviewed respondent via the telephone. According to respondent, she has suffered from PTSD, and because of COVID-19, the things she does to manage the stress became unavailable to her. Since this incident, she has not consumed alcohol. She is seeing a counselor and has support of friends and family. Potential violations may include ARS 3215-0131B, R, D, NP.
And Giesel,
would you like to stop the
community
and you're going to be
speaking on her behalf? I will speak initially on the contact. And then Dr. Bailey, of course, is here and available to answer questions and engage in with her colleagues. In the discussion of issues that they important to you, and there are going to discuss them on position with lawyers helping if we can, but I do think that physician to physician dialogue is critical. So let me try and put into a little bit of context a case that I think most of us would agree when you read it and you hear Gail Smith Anthony's excellent summary, you think, wow, this deserves a very careful look. And indeed it does. But let me start first, and briefly, most of my work, I do complex civil litigation. I also represent groups in front of various regulatory boards, professionals in front of regulatory boards, and my criminal practice currently specific to dealing with individuals who have an underlying mental health or mental well-being issue in their life. So I want to put this case a bit in that those contexts. Let's start first with Dr. Bailey's history. And we may need to go into depth session to explore this more in greater detail if the board sees fit for a closed session to do that. Dr. Bailey had what can only be characterized as a very traumatic event when she was a young. Oh, can you guys hear me? I think somebody may not be muted. Or is it just me? Thank you. When Dr. Bailey was approximately 4 years old, her grandfather, who was a highly respected, indeed an esteemed physician in the Kingman area, had a very unfortunate event in which he committed two homicides, including the murder of his wife and her lover at the time. It was a highly publicized case in that small town, indeed in the state of Arizona. A case that came out of that situation is one of the leading cases in Arizona on insurance companies' ability to deny benefits for their insurers, and there has been an intentional or criminal act. Dr. Bailey found herself at that point as a young child. Her father left his family out of embarrassment. Her mother went back to work full time. Dr. Bailey, over the next few years, became, in effect, the mother of a family and taking care of her siblings. As perhaps was foreordained to be a physician and to be the naturopathic physician, because she kept that family together even as a child, and took care of everyone else in the family. The family endured a great deal of bullying and threats and intimidation. All the other children did fine. Her grandfather remained incarcerated in the Department of Corrections. When she was a young adolescent, she had the onset of anxiety and depression, which was treated in the medical community. And she went on, of course, to do extremely well, become a naturopathic physician, and go into practice in the Sedona area, where she is highly regarded. And in her practice there, I think the letters of support that you've seen from the community, from family, and from her current employer speak to that. Over the course of her early adulthood, in her 20s and so forth, she did have some relapses in her anxiety and depression, and by then we knew, of course, a lot more than we did a couple decades ago about PTSD, about the lingering effects, and most importantly, about the effect of the necessity to treat PTSD by treating the whole person. So Dr. Bailey, using her skills as an naturopathic physician, availed herself not only of medication prescribed by her treating physician, but also a comprehensive menu of wellness tools and interventions that helped her a great deal. One of the features of Dr. Bailey's PTSD, which is, of course, common, are nightmares, sleepwalking, and periods of memory impairment in the midst of a traumatic trigger. Dr. Bailey, and when I met with her, we talked about this response. We explained as clearly and forthrightly as we could that she simply does not recall how she ended up driving her car and having what was a minor traffic accident, but being then disoriented and confused when law enforcement arrived, and she interacted with them. Now, what I'd like to do, she immediately after that realized that she needed to get into psychiatric care. She has now a weekly psychiatric appointment with the psychiatrist who in Sedona has a very large practice and focuses in a holistic practice, as well as, of course, using modern psychopharmaceuticals. She sees him weekly. In our letter to the board and our response, we set forth all the other things that she's doing, which are, of course, critical to maintaining a healthy mental health, as well as addressing some of the neuropsychopharmacology issues that are involved in PTSD, depression, and anxiety. So we do all of that. Let me now turn to the arrest. I think the most important thing is that this case is now almost 90 days old, and there is no prosecution underway. The charges, when you read them off a ticket and you hear words like escape and assault and four counts of this and that, it really sounds egregious and ominous. The reason that Dr. Bailey was taken from Sedona, she was arrested, she was transported to Flagstaff, and after the officers had an opportunity to interact with her in a more normal situation than when they arrived on the scene of the accident, they did not hold her for the purpose of having an initial appearance. They did not charge her. They did not set a future hearing date. They did what's called cite and release. So they cited her and they released her. In these instances, we see one of three things happen. Often, the case is simply not pursued. Second, there may be a direct complaint filed down the road within a year. And third, there can be a grand jury indictment, which is unlikely in this case, in my view. I think it's critical to understand that there was an unknown time lapse between the time of this accident and the arrival of the Sedona police. We simply don't know how long the interval was. We do know, and the basis of the escape, is that Dr. Bailey got out of her car and had gone to the side of the road, and we don't know how, and we don't have an investigator on the case yet. She had dirt, scratches, physical trauma on her body. So that's got to be looked at down the road. The only evidence of her quote-unquote intoxication or being driving under the influence was the portable breath test, the PBT, which is what we think of as a quote-unquote breathalyzer. It's not that, actually, but it's no better, no more, no less than the little pocket gadgets you can buy on Amazon and see how much you've had to drink by blowing in them. It is so unreliable that the courts in Arizona do not permit it to be admitted as evidence in any DUI case, and specifically, it's so unreliable that officers testifying can't even reference it. In other words, they can't say, well, I did a PBT and it was 0.25, and therefore we went to the hospital and we got a blood draw and so forth. You can't even mention it. It's worse than a lie detector, if you will. So this case, from the standpoint of an attorney dealing with mental health and criminal law, I think that the big missing link here is that the Sedona police, for whatever reason, did not take her to Verde Valley Urgent Care Center, where she undoubtedly, given her confusion, her lack of memory, her physical condition,
condition with scrapes and dirt all over her. She would have had at least a CT, if not an MRI. She would have been detained, though. She would have been kept there overnight. And we would have a complete workup, including blood alcohol draws, the BAC. And we know what happened. I'm not sure why the Sedona police didn't do that. I live part-time in Sedona. I think, more indicative of the fact that they just didn't think it was that big of a deal in terms of the case, as opposed to being, you know, reckless and potentially endangering her life and the person in custody by taking her to jail without having her checked out, given her presenting physical signs and symptoms. It's a little surprising. We do know that she was released the next morning and she went about her business and went back, got into treatment, has done extremely well since then. I think one thing that wasn't in the packet that I think speaks boatloads about Dr. Bailey is that she, on her own and on her own determination, without speaking to her original lawyer, her criminal lawyer, called the supervising sergeant in Flagstaff, the supervisor of the officers who had arrested her, and spoke to him and apologized for her behavior. If it was as written in the police report, she expressed remorse and regret and assured him that she was being seen and really, I think, opened up to him about whatever reason that the incident occurred. She regretted it and offered her apology to law enforcement. Now, had she asked me before calling, I probably would have told her don't do that. But that's why lawyers don't always bring out the best in people, right? We sometimes wallpaper over humanity because we're always thinking about how something might be used against our client. But I think in this case, it was a very sweet and very authentic response by somebody who was concerned if what was written was even half true, that she had been very rude to these officers in the course of their just trying to do their job. I think the most important thing is the path that Dr. Bailey has taken and how well she's doing. We have the report, the letter from her employer, and we have also a letter from her treating psychiatrist. Some psychiatrists, treating psychiatrists, will or will not do that. In this case, it appears that Dr. Leon, who is well known in the community and does have forensic case involvement from time to time, felt strongly enough about her safety to practice that he was willing to write a letter to her board and therefore as part of a public record expressing his professional view that she is safe to practice, assuming, of course, that she continues on the path that she's on with her treatment and her holistic therapies to keep herself healthy. One final point, and that is the police report, why she didn't have it. The accident was on the 8th, and she contacted, as she should have, an attorney, Paul Mattern, who only does criminal law, and he handles a lot, you know, a very good lawyer. He confirmed the arrest, but did not take the extra step, did not obtain the police report, because he called and spoke with the Coconino County Attorney's Office, as I understand. I spoke to Mr. Mattern, and there was no case at that point moving forward. And so some attorneys would get all the records that are there at that time. Others would wait and get them after the fact. And that's what Mr. Mattern chose to do, and I don't fault him for that at all. But Dr. Bailey was depending on her lawyer to get the legal documents in the case, including police reports. And that, as a matter of routine, is what most attorneys, including my office, would do. We would tell our client, I'll call and find out what's going on. We'll get copies of the police report. We'll get the Form 4, which is a form that's not included in the police report, but often has more detail. And most importantly, we'll get things like the desk cam, the dashboard cam, or the body cam, which we don't have in this case. So that's not surprising that the attorney took that responsibility. I point that out only because I don't want it to appear that Dr. Bailey was indifferent or unconcerned and did not respond to the board's letter. Her attorney took that under his, as part of his responsibility, and he wrote the initial letters and to the board and told her to self-report. That's my background. I'm happy to answer any more questions about what we've discussed, and Dr. Bailey is happy to respond to questions from the board. I think if we want to get into any discussion of the medications that she is taking, the specific medications for her, then we should probably do that not in a public session.
Thank you, Mr. Goodell. I appreciate it. Thanks for the overview. This is Bruce Sapp. I have a couple quick questions, then I'll turn it over to the other board members. Dr. Rita, are you currently, I know you see Dr. Leung, are you currently also seeing anyone for weekly or once every 2 weeks as a therapist, as a MSW psychologist?
I'm working with a woman named Callie Monroe, who is also at Tribe Wellness Group, and she has a kind of specialty background in post-traumatic stress disorder.
And she's a licensed healthcare professional?
She is.
Okay.
She's a hospital, she's a master's level counselor.
Okay. That's fine.
That's a
And then prior to this whole incident, were you seeing either Kelly Monroe or were you working with Dr. Leung?
No, I was not prior to this incident.
Okay. And I'm going to turn it over to the other board members. We'll start off with Dr. Popeil and work from there.
Dr. Bailey, I know obviously this is a stressful time for you and a lot going on here, and I get that just a point of clarity, I get that the blood alcohol content from breathalyzer is not admissible. The synopsis of the evening was 4 drinks over 4 hours. It's not even close to accurate. And let's just say that let's say the blood alcohol is somewhat accurate. It's even at the extreme level. Was there something else that happened that night? Was there any other reason you would have reacted that way to 4 drinks? Or do you never intend not to drink at all and 4 drinks was way out of the norm for you?
So that night I had done something that I had never done before, which was adding sparkling water to the last 2 glasses of wine because I had plans to go climbing the next morning at 7 a.m. and my friends that I was with said, oh, I can do that, and it helped, you know, it just helped me a little bit feeling better the next morning. And so I had done that. That was the only other thing that was really out of the norm. I don't drink excessively, however, I am somebody who would have a few drinks with a friend, you know, here or there.
Okay. And I think you were gone to bed and then woke up and ended up driving. Is that what happened?
Yeah, so my friends and I had drinks, like I said, over about a 4 hour period. And at the end of that 4 hour period, I went to lay down at my friend's house. She went into her room to call her boyfriend before bed. And that was around 9:30, 10 o'clock. And then, so my intention and plan was to stay there that evening. And then the next memory I have is being in my car on the side of the road.
And I know we're talking about potentially executive session for medication. Were you on any medication at that time?
No, it was supplements. I had taken them that night, but I typically take supplements in the morning and evening.
So there would have been no interactions that also could have contributed to this?
No, I don't know.
questions I have for now.
Doctor, this will sound like an exaggeration, it is not. I would rather, from a medical malpractice standpoint, defend the most complicated neurosurgery or cardiac procedure or even the band of ABK than DUI cases that involve retrograde analysis. We have to be careful that the only way to do a retrograde analysis and try to figure out what somebody's level of intoxication was, either by breath or by blood, we have to have an accurate test and instrument. And the reason that the portable breathalyzer tests, the EBTs, aren't admissible, admissibility is important, but they are just unreliable. And they are unreliable, high, unreliable, low. They are dramatically affected by things like a low-grade temperature, by foods that you've consumed, by chewing gum,
I want to stop you for a second. I appreciate what you're saying about the admissibility, but this is not like a court of law where it would be admissible in office of administrative hearing. It is routinely something that is considered in an administrative hearing, but even in other types of administrative agencies and that kind of thing. So I'm happy and I'm supportive of the board. I don't want to speak for anybody. Happy to consider that information that you're providing. I don't think it's really something we should dwell on.
I appreciate that because that was my point too. I don't even want to debate that in any way, shape, or form. My point is that having an organ and having an organ reaction of that after the fact is really what my concern is, trying to get some answers on that. Regardless of whether the alcohol can add, something just doesn't seem to add up as far as how we got from 4 drinks over 4 hours to end up on the side of the road having an organ.
My question concerns whether Dr. Bailey is aware
of what may have triggered PTSD reaction, and if so, is that something that could be triggered again in another setting, for example, with patients or with any other setting where it may impact her ability to perform as a physician? I guess I'm going to ask you, why would necessarily the blood alcohol level go? The fact that there's no real recollection of how she ended up, where she ended up, if it truly was just the four glasses. Was there any trigger that evening or anything that may have triggered the PTSD, I guess is my question. Or what does Dr. Bailey think are the possibilities to explain what occurred?
What's your thoughts?
Yeah, so my thoughts are, it was around the time of the parole hearing, the second parole hearing, for which I had attended the parole hearing the prior year, and it was very difficult for me, but I was able to, continue practicing, doing my job, getting support that I needed, and then with COVID-19 happening, my stress levels went up significantly, and a lot of my support system fell away. So I know that in the police reports and notes that were made about me there crying about my grandpa and stating that I thought he was trying to call me. So I believe that could have been a trigger if my phone had rang after I went to lay down to sleep, or if I had a dream that he was calling me and I couldn't talk to him. Those would have been the only things that I can really, that would have been a trigger, other than being triggered by the law enforcement, which I have had, I tend to get very nervous
situations where you have been triggered by in a similar way?
No, not in my recent years. When I was younger, I definitely had, times where I would get really upset and nervous around those types of things. But nothing that I've been living in Sedona. I was doing really well here.
If I can add, that's a really good question about what are the triggers, and generically, I don't have to go through the DSM-5 for PTSD diagnosis, but the prominent issue, the first criteria is that a patient is that an individual experiences a symptom, and the context of those symptoms are in three general domains. One is having a bad dream, reliving the trauma through a flashback, or spontaneously experiencing terrifying thoughts when you encounter something that's in the sense of who's not you have to believe. In my initial early comments, I mentioned that Dr. Bailey had, as a child and an adolescent, and through her young adulthood, in issues with nightmares, with bad dreams, and with incidents of sleepwalking, which diminished over time. But I think the issue that you raised there is one that hopefully working with the psychiatrist, and when I first talked to Dr. Bailey, is that I knew I was doing a lot of the things that I needed to do as a naturopathic physician, to take care of myself, but I also knew that with this incident, I needed to go to the psychiatrist to start the counseling weekly to try and get to the bottom of why this happened. I woke up in a sleep and then with not an excessive amount of alcohol and then ended up in this accident. So
I think you've really hit on that important point, and I think that the psychiatrist and the counselor will be able to get to the heart of whether there is, in fact, a trigger, quote unquote. Not all people who struggle or live with PTSD have triggers. They have avoidance symptoms. They will have some arousal, some reactivity symptoms, some cognitive and mood symptoms, you know, being sad or depressed, and you know, sad more than depressed. But so the word trigger is something that is important, and I think, but is not commonplace necessarily, and I think that it's critical with the psychiatrist and the counselor to that Dr. Bailey is addressing that.
Dr. Sadleg, who made the motion to go into executive session? Okay, so Ms. Tibbetts, is that for legal advice?
No, it's for questions to that require respecting her privacy. We've done that before when there's the psychiatric discussion. I guess the way of describing it, things that cannot to be discussed in open session, including medication and other possible topics.
Okay, and so, Ms. Asta, would that fall under the any of the conditions to go into executive session?
Yeah.
Okay, and which one would that be?
I
believe it would be number two, the special considerations that are exempt by law from public information.
Okay.
Okay, so Ms. Tibbetts, you made a motion. Is there a second? All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. 'm going to have to clear that with the Attorney General.
Or do you want to call up? You can call up.
Okay, that would be preferable.
Could you email to them the number? Could you email to them?
Okay.
the communities and align again for the
if you make this an exception of purpose, that will be done for records only.
Yes.
So my phone is, this is my cell number, 602-373-6328. And when you call me, I will then conference in Dr. Bay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is that
online? I am.
Yes, please.
But I thought that had happened I thought that doesn't happen afterwards, but upon reading the police report, I realized that they found me that way. So I have a pretty deep bleeding cut on my right shoulder. I have bruises on both elbows, wrists,
I want to be better. I want to feel good. I want to not have to worry
about anything that are happening to me again. And I definitely plan to continue until I feel that I can spread it out a little bit longer. I may not continue the weekly aggressively until I'm, you know, sure that I'm stable, but I would like to continue and having a full
And do you have any other, is there anyone besides yourself? I understand that, of course, you have family in your corner. Is there any professional that's on your side that is there to champion for you and also hold you accountable respective to the decision that you're making from your forward? In other words, if you decide that, you know, that it's somebody there that might say, well, I think it's better that you're checking in with that therapist every month, or
Dr. Hayman, who's my boss, she has been with me recently, kind of asked me, increase the frequency of that. So there's Dr. Hayman, and then I also have two other of my really close, very close best friends are both naturopathic doctors as well. And I also know that they will be accountable to them.
Okay. Thank you for taking the time to answer my questions, and that's all I have.
Yeah, no, thank you. If I could add a situation in practice that Dr. Lane was reported in practice in the room to the board to express her support and her hope that Dr. Lane would remain in practice there. And that is a very important peer support and peer monitoring mechanism that is in place in this situation, because that naturopathic physician has written to her board as well.
Ms. Davis, questions or comments?
I don't have any at this time.
Dr. Popiel?
I don't have any additional questions.
Dr. Spatt?
I don't have anything at this.
And Ms. Gelb?
Nothing yet.
Okay. So we'll need to make a motion. What we'd like to do, a couple of options would be to make a motion, and some of it could be discussed in a consent agreement. But I will open that open board back up for which way the board's planning to lean in terms of motion.
Dr. Sadler, if you don't mind, what are you considering at this point? Maybe we'll put a couple things on the table to discuss. Are you considering other concern, consent agreement?
Yeah, Dr. Fields, what I was thinking is, you know, based on the information, and I appreciate Dr. Campbell's question, based on the information we have, we don't have a follow-up plan with Sedona PD. So I probably do the COVID with the court. So my thought would be, you know, based on the conduct, obviously, I'm becoming a physician and the intoxication, we would perhaps enter into a consent agreement based on the conduct and intoxication, and then look at what we'd like in the consent agreement. One that would be helpful would be, and I know she's an economic strain, but perhaps once a month, random, whatever good they are, ETOA urine. The other would be to get someone such as Dr. Sumter or some of the board approved, and a list,
for a secondary psychological. I know that Leon, I've seen that, I've read it, for a secondary opinion, just to make sure that the ones in agreement that it's okay for her to practice. But those are some of the items that I'd like to see perhaps in the consent agreement, and that could be, you know, drafted. Those are my thoughts.
I agree that we need some sort of a follow-up of maybe some ongoing alcohol monitoring, potentially. You know, I don't think we need to have any sort of traffic restrictions or anything like that at this point. I think that's all kind of looking at the testing and maybe follow-up in 3 to 6 months would be the way to go as far as getting psychology reports, et cetera, and just checking on the
I concur, it's an unfortunate sequela of events that happened. What's your thoughts on getting a secondary, from a different party, a secondary psychological review for fitness to practice?
I'm not opposed to it. I guess I just don't know enough about the parties involved. It seems like the others would be adequate. I don't know if we need more on top of that, unless there's a question of needing another party and another party to examine everything from an overhead view potentially. But I need maybe more towards just a follow-up report from the parties that were involved.
Propose that rather than putting
this naturopathic physician, out, you know, imposing on her what will certainly be thousands of dollars of expense for a second evaluation, that we provide, ask her psychiatrist to provide even a monthly letter of compliance stating that she is attending, her scheduled appointments and is in compliance with the therapeutic recommendations and her medications. She can also voluntarily produce to you her prescription refill record from her pharmacy on a monthly basis, and she can have her counselor also produce either a monthly report or a quarterly report. So I think those are the things that the board can really see on an ongoing basis through a consent agreement of compliance and pursuing a therapeutic path that gets at the issues in the case. It's sad, you know, our Arizona boards are not like some of the other state boards that have a budget where the board can pay for these kinds of things. I'm not suggesting that that's good or bad, it's just different. But you're asking an acrobatic physician, a practicing in Thomas Cookie, to make the choice between paying her psychiatrist and her counselor and paying the doctor, a psychiatrist, and MD, DO, to write a report. And, you know, we all live with budgets, so I wonder if we can do a consent agreement that provides the board the assurance with ongoing reporting from her, including her employer, her psychiatrist, and provision of her medication receipts from her pharmacy.
And Holly, this is Dr. Bailey. I also want to point out that Dr. Heyman would be more than happy to provide even twice monthly just letters of how I'm doing, or, you know, an overview of how my work is going.
And Dr. Stavik, if I may, I'd like to remind the board that I believe we're in discussion phase.
The board likes to proceed with a letter of concern, or would the board like to move forward and engage with a letter, you know, of concern that it's been given now, or does the board feel that we want to go and do formal with this? So let's start with that, and then if this letter gets us a consent agreement, then let's get into that really quickly. Let me ask Dr. Spath, Dr. Campbell, Ms. Pitts, and board members, how would you like to proceed with this? Dr. Campbell.
Well, when they do a letter of concern, don't we have no ability for follow-up?
I mean, it'd be a consent agreement we're looking at.
Okay.
If we want to craft a consent agreement, or we want to move right from this point to formal and then have her back next month. I think that the best method might be to save on some of her legal expenses and board time might be to do a consent agreement if we can hammer something out quickly now. Or if the board wants to bring her back, we can do that also.
So I will be in favor of just the consent agreement at this point. I don't feel like we need to proceed to formal hearing.
Dr. Campbell,
but this is just bad. I agree with the outline, so
okay. Dr. Campbell.
And I also, on another note, is that I also like the idea that Dr. Bailey and Tony have proposed. I think that's also to have agreement as well. And Dr. Bailey said, I have been counseling, give us a request. So I think that would be also appropriate as well.
Dr. Campbell, your thoughts?
I'm in favor of this consent agreement. I don't feel a business order is necessary or required in this case. I believe that hearing from her physician, her mental health physician over the course of a few months to 6 months, in addition to letters that would be provided to the board, if FEMA any responses concerning, we can respond to that. If not, then we would just revisit this back in 4 months.
Considering it's not a weekly session, and I think maybe it's even more appropriate to have reports every 2 months from the providers.
Especially with the medication profile and the extent of the interaction with Sedona PD, whether it was right, wrong, or indifferent, I still think that report would be helpful. Dr. Campbell, your thoughts?
I fully agree with everybody's opinion thus far. I believe the 2 month report from the psychologist and her working her supervisor master level then with this probably really start twice a month in addition to seeing the psychologist once a month and for all of the criminal case, and if there are any cases come on the way, I will look at them then, and look at you and revisit in 6 months and see how much progress she's made and anything you can be further at that point. If you all think that's a good idea, we will support everything you're doing.
Usually I create the consent agreement, so we're looking at a year probation, every 2 month reports from the providers. Did you want monthly UAs? Okay, monthly UAs, compliance with any prescriptions. You want to see her again in 6 months to present in front of the board to see how she's doing. And it's a year probation. So I guess my question is, do you want me to just put that together and send it to her for signature, or do you want to see that consent agreement prior to the time it gets sent to her?
I think you can send it to Dr. Bailey and her attorney. I mean, this is my opinion. Ms. Kiesel, if you could, I'm sure you would, keep the board apprised of the legal system of transfer, that would be appreciated. And then, yeah, I guess if the rest of the board members are in agreement, we could just send it off to the signature.
I don't think we need to go on that and review it before getting to Dr. Bennett.
Excuse me, this is Sarah Aspen with the EAD. I'd like a couple of minutes, maybe a 5 minute break. You can see.
Okay. So to
do
2:44 and we'll take a break. Is it good to meet then about 2:50?
That would be great.
Yeah,
great.
Okay. We'll reconvene at 2:50 and that's when he's on the line. Please stay there.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Motion carries.
Motion carries.